The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to Pop, the History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
I'm going to fire right in. And okay. There is obviously going to be lots of questions, which I'm sure you've been over before, but I'm going to try and come with a new angle with some of them. And basically, the first thing is, because I remember when I was growing up as a young kid, and anything my mum played or anything my dad played, I immediately rejected. Now, when you grow up in a musical family, I'm just wondering, did you grow up and think, oh God, dad's music, can't stand it. Oh God, mum's singing on this, don't like that. What was your reaction? And when did you actually, probably as a teenager, start to develop your own musical taste?
Okay, so the answer is I couldn't stand my dad's taste in music. Well, actually, it wasn't so much that, it's just the music he played was like country music, and which I really didn't like country music. However, my mother had fantastic musical taste. She liked Earth, Wind and Fire, Aretha Franklin, Thelma Houston, Ricky Lee Jones. I think I don't know if I may have discovered Ricky Lee Jones on my own, I think, actually. But all the old soul stuff, the proper American soul and blues. So I loved my mum's taste in music, and there were many parties at our house because they were very much sort of they were always having parties and always on tour, so very much a musician's lifestyle. Although I hasten to add, in some ways, both coming from quite working class backgrounds, well, very working class backgrounds, they were very grounded. You know, they weren't sort of big drug takers, or, you know, there was probably a bit of dope going around. I imagine it was everywhere in those days. But, you know, it wasn't ugly in any way. It was just everyone was always having a good time. And I remember often dancing around the living room to Quincy Jones, or, you know, singing along to Aretha or whatever it was. So there was that. And I think I started developing my own taste. Really, I loved that soul and blues, although at that age, I suppose I would have been about 11 or 12. So I didn't really recognize the value of blues music in our culture as we recognize it today. And all my friends were into punk rock. And then I was listening to Kate Bush, Ricky Lee Jones. My dad actually put me onto Randy Newman, one of his better likes.
I think a lot of people have the idea of a musical family being, you know, all sitting around the, I don't know, the hearth and singing along or something. And of course, that's a load of bull. In my family, was really my father, even when he was there, he wasn't present. And that really impacted me in my life. And because your parents were musicians, they would have been away a lot. And if you're not away with them, then they're not always present in your life. So how was that for you, and how do you feel that impacted you?
Well, certainly I think you're right. And perhaps that's a generation thing or an age thing, because I think our parents, you know, today's parenting, you know, people actually know what parenting is. I mean, that's the first thing, isn't it? You know, parenting was certainly never discussed. You were just an inconvenience, quite a large one. That's how I was brought up, you know, shut up, get out of the room, don't do that, you know, whatever it was, you can't wear that sort of thing. But they were away a lot. We had a lot of nannies or au pairs. And yes, you're right, total bollocks. Nobody sits around the fireplace playing their instruments and singing with their children. Well, perhaps they do, but they didn't in our family. And my dad, I love my dad to bits, but it's taken me a long time to come to terms with who he is. You know, he wasn't, as many dads of that era, wasn't particularly nice to us. So I think, my dad wasn't present Definitely not. And there wasn't a connection. My mum was very taken up with her career and her life. But there was no doubt that she loved us hugely. And actually, to be fair, in later life, I think my dad definitely loves us to bits, and my, you know, all the grandchildren and everything. So there wasn't a connection when we were young. No, you're absolutely right. And I would say that, no, they weren't really present. And very often we were left to our own devices.
Did you have dreams as a young person?
Great.
Yeah, well, great in one point of view, probably. In another, I'm sure it could be terrifying for the parents as well. Did you have dreams of working in anything else but the music industry? Because if someone said to me, oh, you can do what your dad did, which was a market trader, I would have shot myself. Do you know what I mean?
I guess we always want what we haven't got, don't we? I didn't really think for a minute about what I wanted to do. I just did it, and it was never a consideration. So I only really got to actually making real proper adult choices, well, very late in life, because my life sort of took me by the hand and dragged me through it, you know, and I've been incredibly fortunate. And I've worked very hard as well. Now, because I can't sing and I see how real life affects people, real life, going to work in the same job for 50 years, real life, having that taken away from you, having a pension taken away from you, getting ill, not having traveled, you know, real life's pretty fucking grim, isn't it? Let's face it, you know. So I've been really lucky. I got no idea what I'm talking about. I'm rambling on and I've forgotten my thread completely.
Well, actually, I'll take you to something else, because in retrospect, when you look back at things, they are slightly different and you have a different view of what happened, you know, to you in your earlier years. And your father had a recording studio, and quite some famous people would record in that studio, and you would presumably be there, maybe meet them, maybe hear them recording and so on.
Yeah.
Who was there? And are there any people that you look back on and say, oh yeah, that's where I grasped this. That's where I understood this about a recording process, or about how a voice is used, or how, I don't know, how to phrase things.
Yeah. I think all of that learning about music from other people came much later. I learned a lot from my mum and from the people I sang with. I did backing vocals from the age of, I think, 11 or 12, although I'd done it before that because, as you say, my dad had one of the first multi-track recording studios in London. I met a few people, but really, you know, celebrity was of no interest to me whatsoever because I was a child. And the people that I remember, we had an engineer at the studio called John Wright, and he used to drive a Black Rover 100, and he used to teach us to make little insects out of soldering wire. So that is, you know, that's a very creative thing, and it's very caring of him as an adult to spend time with children, you know, doing that. So I think it was more, I learned more, and not necessarily about music, but I learned more about people through meeting people who worked within the creative field, if you like, because when you do music every day, you're alive every day. You know, you talk about your dad not being present. That's because he was working really hard, probably. And I'm not forgiving him or passing any judgment at all. But when you're working within the creative field, if you're doing music or art, or if you're on tour, everything changes all the time. Everything around you changes, or you work in one place, as in a studio, and the people come through it change, you know, everything changes, the music changes, and so you kind of have this ongoing nature of adaptability, which I think is, you know, it's massive. God, I hesitate to use the word gift, but I can't think of any other word, but it is, you know, it's normal people don't get to experience that. And it really is a fantastic thing to be a part of in every way.
I mean, also developing your musical voice.
Yeah,
that's good. It sounds a bit weird. But to develop that voice, I presume that your mother played a very important role in that, because you mentioned about the singers that she loved, and that's what she introduced you to. where do you feel your musical voice started to develop, and can you sort of explain that process?
I think, oh gosh, that's really difficult. I think my early songs were pretty rubbish, actually, a lot of them. But
is that because there's the depth of which you could go into yourself at that stage because of the life events that happened to you later, which we'll come to, but the depths of what you could express in those, you know, in early years is very different to what we can do today as people. I'm a writer, and my voice is based in my pain as well. And I know when I feed on that pain, what I write on the page will move people, and it moves me. And I imagine it's the same for you.
It was, it is, not so much anymore, it's different now, but you're absolutely right. And I think as a child, I think that there was, I did feel pain, emotional pain. I don't know why I did, but I did. And I think having two children of my own now, I think some people inherit that type of personality, you know. So I think that some people are born with the pain. And some people, the pain is exacerbated through whatever their life has been up to that moment. I was left on my own a lot. I was left in charge of a big house a lot when I was very young, so from the age of 12 or 13. So, and I didn't feel sorry for myself, but I was able, but I went into myself. So I'm quite, I tend to go inwards, you know. And I think it came from there. And I think you're right. I think that one connects with a feeling, whether it's pain or happiness, but it's actually when you actually really feel a feeling. I mean, the song Stop, the woman in the song, I think she's obviously a plonker. She should leave the bloke. What on earth is she thinking of, right? And that is so not the person I would think that I am. But I do relate to that, you know, the pain of love. So I'm not quite sure where that came from. But that's Stop is an interpretation of a feeling. And I think that all songs are interpretations of feelings, aren't they, as you say. And when you connect with your own feelings, other people can feel that. That's how I see it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think what, you know, that's why I'm mentioning it as a voice, because as a voice in terms of what you're trying to express to the world, not in terms of the singing voice, but in terms of the voice within you, it's really important. You know, we see it in all films. That's why we cry during a movie. That's why we're touched. You know, when we go and see a play, that's why a piece of music will motivate us to have some feelings that relate to us, not necessary to the person that wrote it. So I think those things are really important. Now, you, when you were a young teenager, did your first session work. And I just wondered, it was with, I think it was with Steve Marriott, wasn't it, of the Small Faces? And your mother was also there. What advice do you remember that she gave you during that process? Because she must have guided you at that time.
Well, I think, you know, my mum wasn't an advice-giving type of person. My mum was somebody who was very positive. She would have, I don't actually remember any specific words, but I do remember her attitude would have been, it'll be fine, don't worry about it, it's going to be fine. You know, just kind of stick to what you need to do and don't worry about it. So, and also by that time, I'd probably done quite a lot of singing in studios already anyway. So it wasn't like a big reveal. It was, I also knew Steve Marriott very well. He was a very good friend of the family. So I knew him well, and I'd met all the other guys because they'd been to my dad's studio. So it was really like they were kind of like, oh yeah, no, Sammy, get Sammy on this. We'll have her on it, you know, little Sammy, whatever they called me. And so it was more that. So it was very much a family event. It wasn't the kind of turning up for professional engagement type of thing. It would have just been a laugh. I mean, everything that I did with my mum, and in fact, singing as a professional backing singer, it was always fun. There was never any element of you're not doing your job right, or we're not paying you because that wasn't good enough. Although in later years, mum and I did get thrown off a French session for being a bit drunk and raucous, I seem to remember.
What happened?
Well, I don't know. We were probably just giggling and swearing or something. Oh, God, who knows?
I mean, you weren't the only member of the family. You've got a younger brother.
Yes,
obviously, you've been working with on practically everything, not everything completely, but practically everything in your life. Was there a touch of sibling rivalry as you were sort of young, or were you always close?
We weren't always close. We got on okay, but we each had our own friends. And then Pete moved into London when he was 16 and became what we used to call a tape op at Power Plant Studio. So he left home at 16, very young, and he worked with all sorts of fantastic people. And we kind of parted company then for quite a few years, because I moved into London at the same time. Well, it was about the same time. I was 17, because I'm a bit older than him. And I just did session work and wrote songs and did a bit of cleaning and a bit of waitressing. So that was that. So we were both in London. And what happened was I signed to A&M Records, which took a long time to come about, because the guy that I wanted to sign to, Brian Shepherd, was at Phonogram, and then he was leaving Phonogram, and it took 2 years. So they told us they were going to sign us, and then we were hanging around for quite a long time. And then basically A&M, Brian and Chris Briggs, put me into the studio with a lovely producer called Pete Smith, who did Dream of the Blue Turtles. He's a great producer. But it was very much a kind of, it sounded very session-y. It was the top session musicians, all of whom are still great friends and lovely people. But it felt a bit clinical to me. It felt a bit session-y, if I'm honest. And Pete saw it in a different way. I think he saw it more kind of a bit heavier, a bit rough around the edges. And we kind of talked about it. And I would have been 20 at this point, 21. And then we started working together, and then we started to realise that we got on really well, and we worked very well together. So, yeah.
So when you say that was a bit session-y, how did you move away from that? What was his role in that, and how did you actually take it away from that area?
Well, I think Pete's very much, he's very much a self-taught musician, and he's a guitarist, so obviously has to be centre stage. So that was me out of the picture straight away. No sibling rivalry here at all, Steve. So it was a bit rockier, really, and he'd been working with some different people. Also, my foster brother, Richard Newman, who's Tony Newman's son, who used to play with T-Rex and Bowie, and he was a session drummer. He was playing with the Everly Brothers. So that was Uncle Tony, who was bonkers. And Rich was also living in London, and he was he is the most amazing rock drummer. He played with Rory Gallagher. He's recently played with Paul Rodgers. He's a fantastic drummer, real energy about him. And so basically we treated it more like a band situation, if you see what I mean. So we rehearsed up the songs as a band, and it was a bit less overdubby and more bandy. But we used some of Pete Smith's tracks as well, so it was a real mixture.
Had you been writing? I know you've been writing poetry. Did you start to write poetry when you were young, or is that something that came later? I'm just wondering how that process of writing lyrics and writing songs, where that really came from and where that started.
Well, I think really all of my songs, most you could say 98% of my songs from day one have come from the words. And I think it's taken me quite a long time to actually, as you say, find my voice musically, because I didn't really have a concept of genres. And I know that sounds a bit mad, but I didn't think, oh, no, I want to be a blues singer, or no, I want to be a pop singer. I wasn't keen on popular music, which was the 80s, you know, wasn't really that keen on punk rock. I didn't quite get that. I loved the fashion and some of the attitude, but I was quite a gentle person, really. So I was writing philosophy, a massive Stevie Wonder fan. So I think I kind of picked up on that kind of spread the love vibe in music, you know. So it was about creating music that had an idea and a philosophy behind it. And so the words were really important to me. And that's what came first. The words always came first. And then the music came afterwards. And it took me a long time, I think, to understand musically songwriting, how to craft a song, and how for it to work musically.
I mean, if we go back though to that first album, the first single off that album didn't really move too much. And I remember that you've told in interviews that even when Stop came out, that I'm not sure if it was when Stop came out or it was when the first single came out, that the BBC didn't play it.
No,
yet
not
you were played in Europe. No. Sorry?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. The BBC didn't pick it up. They didn't pick up any of my music. I think possibly had something to do with the fact that my dad and Uncle Tony were blacklisted by the BBC because they went to, I think it was the Eurovision Song Contest, and my mum and Tony's wife were doing backing vocals. And I got this vague idea of a story where they went into the Grosvenor House Hotel and fish hooked all the tablecloths together and laid them on the floor. And then when everyone was sat down, they pulled them tight so that when the waiters came round, all the tablecloths came off. Now, that could just be a completely made up story, but that's what I heard. And I think my dad may have possibly misbehaved. And so, you know, the BBC have never really wanted to play my stuff. I mean, it's different now because obviously I've known a lot of these people for years and obviously have been on radio shows and stuff. But it took for Stop to go to number one in about, I think it was about 7 countries before they actually would play on the radio in England.
So but your success initially was in Europe. Have you ever thought about why it was Europe that took to you?
I think it was because the record company worked bloody hard at marketing and promoting it. I don't think that success in music, if I'm really honest, has got that much to do with the music. I really don't. I think that the record company picks something up, they can sell it if they want to. Depends on whether they've got a strong opinion about something. I don't think I probably didn't do myself any favours because I was quite outspoken and I didn't think I was, obviously, but I certainly wasn't. I was like, well, no, I'm not doing that. That's rubbish. Why would I want to do that? You know, so it's kind of, I wasn't really up for playing the game. Didn't care if I was famous or not. I wanted people to hear my music, but I was very happy that I'd made a record and I didn't really care how many people heard it. So from their point of view, I probably wasn't an awful lot of use.
I mean, you were played to death with Stop on MTV around Europe. You know, that was, you know, I remember that vividly because obviously sitting in the office, see you, you know, 20 times a day. How did you feel about that image of you? Because a video, you know, a 3-minute or 4-minute video presents the image of an artist which is in that video and reinforces that particular image. So for the wider public, you are that person, as Madonna was that person in Like a Virgin. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it is this reinforcement and it may not be the person. So I just wondered how you felt about your image in the video and whether that felt like you at all and if that was uncomfortable then.
I love your question, Steve. I love this. This is great. It's really like, you know, obviously your years at MTV or just in the music industry, it's just great. You're completely connected to it all. It's fabulous. I love it.
Thank you.
So basically, when I first went to the record company, I was a bit goth, what would have been goth, although such a thing didn't exist. But I loved vintage old long black clothes. And I had a big black floppy hat I used to wear. And I was incredibly shy. And really didn't like myself very much, you know. So actually this whole thing of, you know, and makeup, I had a couple of bad experiences with makeup artists who were like, oh god, you know, what we're going to do here, because I never went to the beauty parlor. I didn't give a shit about whether I had hairy eyebrows or, you know, I just wasn't where my priorities lay at all. So I found the whole thing quite difficult, but you know, I'm a quick learner. And I realized that, you know, I was in it. This is what I was doing. I was promoting a record. It's a business. I am now a can of beans. So I need to behave and do as I'm told because this is my job. I've signed up for this, you know. So I think the image of me in Stop has got absolutely nothing to do with me at all. And it does not in any way reflect who I was at the time.
Do you think there was a certain naivety on your part in terms of knowing what the, considering, you know, what your parents did, knowing what the music industry is, or definitely was at that point? I don't know if it is, because I'm not really that involved in it. But, yeah, you know, if that really was that, and that you were actually quite naive to expect it to be something different.
I absolutely was totally naive. I wasn't, I had no concept of what the music industry was. I lived with music and musicians. I didn't live in the music industry. It was a horrible shock. It was a really horrible shock, you know, because I'd seen, I suppose the most I'd seen of it was my dad and his attitude towards publicity, which he didn't really like it. But he was basically like, you don't show the bastards anything. You know, you don't give yourself away. You don't tell the truth in interviews. You don't, you know, you tell them what, you know, it's all an act. Whereas as the first thing he said to me was about our meeting. And I suppose what I took away from my dad's attitude, which I do understand, and I think it provides a safety net, and it's sensible, actually. It is sensible because it draws, you know, it gives people boundaries, which is good. But for me, and I know this can sound incredibly hippie, but every person that I meet is there. They, you know, you are you, and I am meeting you. And that is, to me, valuable. And because I'm not doing it to, you know, to further my career, because I was actually, because I was working for a record company. But from my own point of view, what was more important was how I was spending my time and whom I was spending my time with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you said something very interesting there. You said, I was working for a record company. Now, isn't that, you know, it may be the reality, but that is, to me, it's a weird thing to say.
Is
when
it?
When you're an artist, it's like, I don't know, it's like, fuck them, well, this is me. You know, this is what I want to do.
Yeah, but actually having the confidence to do that is, I didn't have the confidence to do that. You know, I was on the back foot already because I didn't look the part, I didn't act the part, and I didn't want to do the things they wanted me to do. So everything was a compromise and a battle. And when you, you know, the thing is, when you make music and you write songs, at this point, I should say, I'd been to America to write with people. I'd written with lots of other people. I'd collaborated with people. I'd been working with musicians. I'd been doing music for, let me think, you know, probably 6 or 7 years already. And I think it was a shock because they just weren't interested in music and they didn't know the first thing about it, as far as I could tell. You know, they didn't know when something felt right. And when you work in music, it's really important that it feels right, because it's not like working in an orchestra, or you know, you're making it up. You know, if you go in to do a backing vocal session, you usually write the backing vocals, you usually create the backing vocals. And, you know, and that's how it was. So to have it sort of formularized and set in front of you, and it's like, but you can't do that, and you can't do this, and you have to do this, and you have to behave like that. And, you know, it's just, it wasn't that I was a difficult person, but it was a shock.
Is that what happened with the second album? Because there must have been enormous pressure on you to come back with another Stop.
Well, I think they wanted that. And to me, that seemed incredibly short-sighted. I did, however, write at least 3 rocking blues soul ballads, which are really good. And, you know, there's a... Sorry, there's someone outside my window, Steve. I don't know what's going on.
Give them a wave. I'm
going to shut the window. There we go. I did do that, but the thing about Stop was it wasn't indicative of my music anyway. It's the one that they picked up on, but it was the, you know, it was the odd one out, definitely. And the blues soul element for me came later, really, when I started working with Jules, and I started to really understand it and where it came from. And
one thing we have in common, and this is a tough one, it's a tough one for me as well, is I nursed my mum, who had cancer, for 3 years. She had lung cancer. She was a lot older. She was 93 when she died. And I'd been incredibly close to my mum in my life. And in the last 15 years, I live in Germany, and I would travel backwards and forwards and look after her. And it grew and grew and grew until I lived there the last 3 years and accompanied her until the moment she died. So I went through that whole process. And I hope this isn't difficult, because I do find talking about it valuable for me as well. That when her diagnosis came, I mean, I was with her when her diagnosis came, and it's obviously incredibly difficult for the person when they get that diagnosis, but it's also incredibly difficult. And I would imagine it was also incredibly difficult for you at that moment, because like me, I was trying to be strong and trying to say to her, okay, you know, like there's still time. Hopefully we can enjoy these things and all that sort of stuff. And at the same time in my head, and I wondered if that was there with you, that I was thinking, shit, what the fuck am I going to do without mum? And I just wondered if you went through that whole process as well, and how you remained strong, or did you manage to talk about it with your mum?
Well, yes. Okay, so where do I start with this? It wasn't... So my mum went... She was 50 when she died. She was very young. And she only discovered she had cancer because I made her go to the doctors. I said, you've got to go, that's not right, go to the doctors. And she went, and she was diagnosed with bowel cancer. Now my mum and I we were very, very close, and we worked together a lot, and we had a filthy sense of humor. And we, when she was diagnosed, I can't remember the time scale, but around that time, we got pissed one night, and we wrote 3 pages. It was basically, you know, it's like, well, Mrs. Brown went to the doctor with her piles swinging gently between her left thighs. And, you know, it was absolutely, the whole thing was hysterical. So basically, completely different to your experience, we both completely took the piss out of it, is what happened initially. And then I think my mum was a very, she really wanted to be happy all the time. She very much felt strongly that there was no point ever in being negative. She was completely positive. She changed her diet. She looked after herself, but she didn't want to read about it. She didn't want to talk about it. Myself and my brother said, look, it would be really good if you did just, this is a bit further on, if you did just go and do a bit of counselling, you know, or see somebody. And she went, and she came back, she said, I'm not bloody going back there. I said, why not? They said, they made me cry. I'm not doing that again, you know. And it was like, because, you know, she hadn't necessarily had a really easy time of it. So I think she basically ignored it. Mum basically ignored it. And I think that, and she just lived her life to the best of her ability outside of what she had to do. So she had bowel cancer, and they operated on that. And then they found she had secondary liver cancer, which is what killed her. She just remained very positive. She knocked up a whacking credit card bill by buying dresses from Vogue, which I think she left for my dad. And she just blipped. She sit. I remember her being in the, because she had health insurance, which I don't have, but she was in the London clinic, and she'd be there with all the magazines with it hooked up to her chemo, you know, which made her so very ill. And she'd be there, and she'd be going, and she'd flick through, and she'd go, pass me the phone, and she had a landline, obviously, in those days. And she phoned up both. She said, yeah, can you? I want to buy the dress on page 195. Yep. £2,000. Yep, that's fine, in white, thank you. Yes. And she literally just, she was, it was like, you, bollocks to you, cancer, I am gonna really live my life. And she did. She looked amazing. She carried on singing. She very publicly dealt with her cancer in Holland.
I've seen excerpts on TV shows. Yeah, I've been watching them, and quite, you know, I felt like, oh god, that's a really tough, in a live show in front of a live audience, to ask about someone's cancer when clearly And you can see in your mother's face that she's presenting hope, but at the same time, you have this feeling she knows. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that she said something like, well, they said there's nothing that can be done, but there is another treatment. So she was grasping onto a little bit of hope, which I experienced with my mum, that everything was always this little bit of hope that it isn't going to happen. And I thought, wow, that she's a powerful woman to be able to deal with that situation and sing on a show. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, she was. She was amazing. And you know, she really had no confidence. And so she made her last years really count. She really did. And that, and in Holland they have there's a couple of places, and it's called the Vicky Brown House, because she became quite famous in Holland. And it's a place where people can go to talk to other people with cancer, to discover alternative therapies. And actually, I think, you know, I was very angry after my mum died, and I've seen a couple of interviews that I did where I was like, whoa, you know, you are really struggling there, you know. But I did learn a lot from it. And I think when your life is hopeless, when really there is not going to be a happy ending, what are you going to do? Are you going to go, oh, well, it's going to be a bad ending, I just won't bother? Are you going to go, well, I'm just going to crawl into a hole? No, you're not. You're going to do positive things that make you feel happy and that are good. And, you know, and that's what she did. And it was lovely, lovely to see.
One of my most amazing memories of my mother was two nights before she died. And at that stage, I'd got a hospital bed in the front room, and I'd slept next to her for 2 weeks, and you do everything. I mean, and I mean everything at that point, obviously, but we were incredibly close. And two nights before she died, she said, I want to talk to you. And I knew this was going to be the last communication. You know, I knew this was going to be the moment that she was going to say what she wanted to say. And it was the most beautiful thing, and it will never, ever leave me, that she told me what she wanted for my life. You know, she started off and she said, I want you to meet a man who is as kind to you as you have been to me. And then she looked from the future to say what I was doing with my life, all along the lines of what I want in my life. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So I have this sort of vision of when I'm low, and I feel like, oh God, things aren't going that well, then I think of that moment and it will pull me back. And I wondered if you had a moment with your mum that, you don't have to tell me what it is, but that moment where you can cherish and you can look back and that gives you the will to carry on.
I don't think there is a specific moment for me, actually. But I think, as I get older, I have so many good memories of being with my mum. And I think what happened for me was when she died, a part of her, sounds really bad, but a part of her lived on in me. You know, so I started to recognise her in myself, almost like she was inhabiting me, you know. And I think, and it's definitely a subconscious thing. I don't think it's a conscious thing. So whether it's my own brain doing that for me, or whether it's a real thing where part of my mother's spirit does inhabit my body, I don't know. But, you know, it's fine with me because it means she's there. And obviously I have children, and it is so sad because she was by far the nicest person in our family. The rest of us are twats, really.
I mean, you created an album in her honour.
I did.
Afterwards, 43 Minutes, which I was listening to this morning, and it completely moved me.
Oh, God.
no, because I wanted to listen to it before the interview, and it completely moved me because I have a similar experience, obviously, and I thought that was wonderful. And what you said at the end, my mother is with me, and I don't know what that means either. I do think it's just that you're so closely connected that they do feel like they're with you for the rest of your life, and that is a very beautiful thing. One thing that I had afterwards was a complete reorientation. Because your parents, if you imagine like being on a train and your parents, and I think your closest parent is the train ahead. So they're the ones it's like you're orienting yourself towards the train ahead. You're following them. And then that train's gone. And it's like, oh fuck, what do I do with my, where do I go now? What do I do with my life? And that album is, for me, someone who's trying to grasp that and someone who's going through that process, which is the beauty of that album. Was it, you know, you mentioned that it was hell afterwards and these interviews where you don't even sort of recognize yourself today. But was that a moment of reorienting yourself and really like deciding what to value in life had changed?
Yes, it was. I think it was all of those things. One of the reviews of the album said it was therapy. And I think in some ways it was. I mean, it took me, I don't know how long it took me to write the album, but I literally was just at home. I was very lucky. I had a house in Stoke Newington, which I loved. I had my piano in the living room, and I just holed up. And luckily, I could afford to not worry about money. And I just took the time I needed, and I wrote the album, and I played it again and again, and then we recorded it. But I think it's quite interesting lyrically, because as you say, it has got everything in there, hasn't it? You know, and strangely, 43 minutes has been by far the most I've been connected with my audience. So I get a lot of letters, and certainly at the time. So basically, I recorded it, and then Howard Berman at the record company, who's head managing director of the record company, said his words were, creatively it's brilliant, commercially it's a disaster. And he wanted me to just record a cover or something and stick it on the end. So they had a sing, and I said, I don't think so, you know. So eventually, so we couldn't get the album back, but I was a recouped artist. So eventually, because my manager was arguing with the people there and blah, blah, blah. And I just went in one day and said, look, Howard, I said, I don't think we have a future working relationship. And I'm fully recouped. I'd like to go. And he let me go. It took me a while to get the album back. But then I did gigs. Herbie Flowers helped me enormously. And he'd say, oh, there's this little gig by me in a church. Should we go and play a few songs off your album? Because he played on the album. So I did little bits and pieces like that. And then what happened was that really grew. It never sold loads of copies. But this connection with the audience grew because, as we talked about before, the pain in whatever form it was in the album. And actually, I think people, and certainly for myself, if I listen to music, I want to hear the essence of the person that I'm listening to. And people just really related to it, because of course everybody loses somebody, you know. So it was an interesting, really interesting thing to look back on now, you know.
You I don't know if the word retreated is right, but you retreated into family life after that for a while. And I don't know if that's the right word, because it's to you'd sort of went off and had a family. Maybe that's the fair way of saying it.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, and how important was it for you to be the mother after having the mother that you had?
Well, I think, I don't think I did. I didn't retreat. I retreated from music industry life. I think what happened was, basically, I realised throughout my mum's illness, so before and after she died, that what I was doing wasn't me. You know, I did a lot of, I mean, I was 3 years on the road promoting Stop. It's a lot, you know, 20 interviews a day, all over the world. It was hard work, had a great time, but I didn't do any music. And I think I just knew that that wasn't what I wanted to do, regardless of whether I was successful or not. So basically, my musical life, I still kept writing. So I was still writing and working. And of course, the Pink Floyd thing came up, which was great. So it wasn't, having children, I would say, really was a chemical decision rather than a psychological decision. I was ready to have kids. I wanted to have kids before my mum died, but that didn't happen. It took me a long time to get pregnant. So I didn't have Vicky till 1993, and then went on tour with Pink Floyd in 1994. So I was still working. I didn't kind of withdraw, if you like, at any point.
Was the Pink Floyd tour a sort of supportive environment, because as you know, I know Durga, who I adore.
Oh, right.
I mean, Durga's Durga's a toughie. You know, there's no doubt about it. Yeah. She's opinionated, but she's one of those people you can't ignore. And, you know, she's got a wonderful heart. Mm. And I can imagine there was sort of almost like somewhat of a family atmosphere, because Dave Gilmore is actually a very nice person, you know.
Yeah. So, the manager and the tour manager, Steve, what's his name? Pink Floyd's manager, who's dead now. Steve O'Rourke. And Tony, what is the matter with my brain? I'm getting old, that's trouble. Anyway, basically, they didn't want me to go on the tour. And I got phone calls from both of them. But Dave, because Dave asked me, this was the third time I've been asked to do Pink Floyd. And I really wanted to do it. But each time he called me, I had other things. And I'm not a person who will cancel everything. I'm like, I've agreed to do this, so I'm doing this. So it never happened. I'd worked with Dave a lot. I'd known him for a long time. And I'd done the backing vocals on the Division Bell. So anyway, I said, look, fine with me. I said, but I'm not doing the tour unless my daughter can come with me. She was 3 months old when we did the album. They were like, you can't bring a baby on this tour, blah, 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 blah. And they're both lovely men, both of them. Tony Howard, Steve O'Rourke. And I did end up going. And actually, Vicky was just the joy of the tour. Everyone loved her and we had a great time. Durga was kind of partying quite a lot at that point. So her life and mine didn't really, I mean, obviously we got fine and the tour was fine, but I did get very close to Claudia because Claudia was a bit more of a stay in her room. She's a bit slower. She liked to join. So we'd go out for walks with Vicky and she's very peckham. She very sadly died. I don't know if you know, but a couple of years ago now, way too young. But we got great. And yes, it was, you know, they really looked after us. And there were lots of other kids on the tour. So Nick and Nettie's children were there, had two boys. Dave and Polly were just getting together, but Dave's kids were around as well. So, you know, it was a family atmosphere. We were very looked after. It was a great thing to do.
How do you see your development in your albums over the years in terms of their musicality? Because you said you look back and you see the stop era as, well, I'm gonna choose a word for you, but it isn't really right, sort of more bubblegum in relation to what you do today. So I'm just wondering how you see your own musical progression and how you value your own music today. And do you find the latter stuff much better in your own terms than what you did earlier?
I think what we're talking about here is production values. I don't think my songwriting's changed that much. I think hopefully I've got a bit better at it. wait till you hear my new stuff. It's about production, isn't it? You know, and I think I was so sort of, it's quite interesting when you're a sort of blossoming singer-songwriter, which I saw myself as a singer-songwriter. So Joni Mitchell, I didn't mention before, but, you know, a big fan of singer-songwriters from a very early age. But the record company, it just wasn't fashionable. So Stuart Horner, my publisher, who I'm still really with now, sent me over to America. And then hence I wrote Stop and some other bits and pieces. But I think I've become much more aware of genres as I've got older. And I think that it's a shame that there's not more creativity within record companies, where they can, rather than trying to get the artist to do something or criticizing them, they focus on one particular aspect of what they do and say, look, why don't we do an album? I mean, because Stop was all over the place, you know. I mean, they said to me, you know, it's too mixed. Although I think it's one of its strengths, but there was jazz, there was kind of a bit of sort of country, there was dance music, there was, you know. So I would have said, look, how about we've got Stop, why don't we do a blues album? Because that is then something that the artist can relate to and focus on. Does that make sense? But I think really what you're talking about is production values. And I think that I just was never very confident. I really only got my confidence when I started working with Jules Holland, and he was very good for me as a friend and still is, and encouraged me to be who I was, which hadn't really happened up until then. And as close as I am to my brother, he's a very strong personality where music is concerned. And I had to at some point kind of disconnect from that, not with Pete, because we're very, very close. But I needed to go off on my own and just try things on my own, because I'm quite slow and have to do things at my own pace and on my own, because I can't bear people watching what I'm doing. So I'm not a person to go and go, no, it's got to be like this, we're going to do this, you know. So that took a long time for me to do. And I still don't really have a concept of what that sounds like to other people. I mean, obviously, it's much more organic, certainly the last few bits and pieces I've done. Does that answer the question, Steve?
Well, the other thing I wanted to talk about, because you lost your voice.
Yes.
And that must be, for a singer, a real, you know, a real loss. It's, you know, it's a really big thing if you're a singer to lose your voice. And I just wondered, in essence, how you have come over that and be able to say, okay, I can move on from this and I can still do things without having this, you know, what has been special to me my whole life, which is my voice.
Well, I don't really, I mean, if I'm really honest, so I lost my voice in 2007. And I've only just got to the point which you've just so very beautifully put. And I think it was because in lockdown, I started, because everyone was saying to me, you can still write, you're a really good writer, you know. But when I wrote, I used my voice to write the songs. And so, you know, it's difficult. But I've been teaching ukulele since 2010, which I love, but which hasn't been great for my voice and still isn't, because I have, even if it's really bad, I have to sing to get them to play, because people who are not musicians, they don't just suddenly pick up and sing loud. And if you're not singing, it's very hard to get the feel of the music going. So I had to sing, which has been destructive, I have to say, but it's also been good in other ways. But in lockdown, what happened was I got back in touch with my friend Danny Shogger, and I said, we've been talking about writing for ages. And he's always been great with me. If things have been difficult in the past and I've had trouble with doing vocals, I mean, Pete's fantastic to work with as well. But Danny is he's a gentle friend. He's very kind and he gets it. And so I've done the work I've done with him on occasions, he's very good with vocals. So, and so I said, you fancy writing? I said, I think I'm about ready to have a go. I said, I've got a few ideas. And I said, I've written a couple of sort of instrumental electronica things. Do you want to hear them? And I sent them over. He said, oh, yeah. He said, well, we'll do a bit of writing. Anyway, we've written an electronica album, but it has got singing on and it's all auto-tuned. And I think, well, fuck it, I've earned my stripes. If anyone's allowed to waltz tune, I am. And I look back and I think, God, I sang so in tune and now it's so awful. It's like,
what is it about the ukulele that you love? Tell me, what you know, it's an odd, it just seems, well, I don't know, maybe it isn't an odd choice, but in my head, it's sort of like, oh, the ukulele, it's an odd, and I know it's very, it's sort of in, isn't it? Oh, there you go. There you go, Sam Brown on the ukulele. Yeah, cool.
All right, so you could play anything on the ukulele. I haven't got my glue on nails, so I'm going to be a bit rubbish, but you can play, let me think. Oh, God. So what most people do is they go for a pop song that they want to play, Baba Love, excuse my voice, Baba Happiness, Hello Loneliness, I think I'm gonna cry. All right, okay, so you've got that. That's your obvious thing, three chords. Wow, I can play an instrument, that's brilliant, hooray. But then you can do things like, see if you know what this is. Thank you. ready?
Pinwheel Watson, young man. Pinwheel right? Watson. Is it Pinwheel Watson?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Boy, I played the silver ball from Soho down the right. And I still played them all. All right, so you can play that on a ukulele. You can play Putting on the Ritz. You can play beautiful songs. I mean, the famous one is. Twilight sings a song of the so you know there's so much you can do, and I think it's a really lovely way to learn music, because learning music, there's so much you have to learn. There's chord structure, there's, you know, how what a chord is made up of, there's strumming patterns, because essentially, like a guitar, it's a rhythm instrument. And I suppose what really got me doing it was I couldn't play it. So because I couldn't play it, I was learning, and a couple of people said, can you teach me? So I was like, well, yeah, but I don't really know what I'm doing myself. So I've learned with my pupils, and it's been great, great fun, good fun. You can't take it too seriously, though, obviously.
That's brilliant. It's brilliant to have an outlet and to be able to do something creatively, because you obviously absolutely need to express your creativity today as well. And one thing you said at the beginning was that, you know, that sometimes life can, you know, give you shit, and, you know, you've had your fair share throughout your life. But I started with something which I want to say again, that I really do think one thing you haven't lost, and you may have lost your voice along the way, but one thing you haven't lost is this innate warmth and kindness. Aww. It's still there. And it was lovely to talk to you. Thank you, Sam Brown.
Lovely to talk to you. Can we go for a drink one day, Steve?
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.